turn to our bug bite section and take a look at a couple of really interesting insect facts or bites about these insects. And one of them has to do with galls. And I remember taking a class from Ivan Palmblad at Utah State University. It was Biology 106, which I guess now would be 1060. And it's really what got my interest going, not only in insects, but just the natural world around me, because he assigned things to you that you had to pay attention to. One of those topics that I personally took an interest in were galls, because I'd seen them on blue spruce and
common on sage and rabbit brush.
And a couple of different other trees. Yep. And I remember opening up the gall that I had seen on a blue spruce, and it looked like a little teeny apartment complex.
Exactly.
I mean, just little teeny insects all over the place.
That's a great description.
So that's what I wrote in my paper, and he loved it.
Yeah.
But that's what it is.
Aren't galls fascinating?
Yeah.
And so this fairly recent story that was in the Entomology Today about insect galls, really brings home how amazing, how diverse, how evolutionarily advanced some of these insect gall makers are, but at the same time, how little we as entomologists, as humans studying them, really know about them and how they work and how they can make the galls and how these galls can be so perfect little apartment complexes. But let's back up and say, you know, what are galls? Why would an insect want to make a gall? So you just brought up one point by saying apartment complex, because it makes a home for it, right? So it makes this great habitat where the young in particular, because they usually leave the gall when they're adults and go off and make more galls for their young. So it's the place to live. But what else do you think might be so ideal about this little complex or gall that they make? What's the insect have access to? An unlimited supply right there.
The food
and the food that it wants and the way that it wants it. So the way that they think, and we don't know this, it may even differ across different kinds of gall-making insects, but we think what they're doing is injecting a fluid. Generally, we think it's coming from their salivary glands, but there may be other sources of fluids that we are just not sure about yet. They inject into the plant, and that these mimic a plant hormone. So these are chemicals that regulate plant growth and development, and basically kind of intervenes with their normal genetic code that says, okay, this bud's going to grow into a flower or to a leaf or a stem or whatever it's genetically coded to do. And it alters that. So it's still a leaf or a stem or a flower bud, but now it doesn't look like it normally does and doesn't function like it normally does. It's now become this insect apartment complex. And so it basically is interrupting or interceding or putting into the genetic code something different to make it grow into its desired shape and structure.
So the insect is sitting there on the limb, and it's having this form around it?
Yeah, so that's exactly what happens. So the way they generally work, and again, there's some variation, but the insects will lay their eggs in very particular, precise places on the plant that they're going to make this gall. And so the eggs hatch, and it's actually the young that start to feed. And most of these have a sucking kind of mouth part, but not all. There's galls. Gall wasps and gall flies that have different kinds of mouth parts. So exactly how they do it, that's what we're not sure. How like a fly with a sponging mouth part can make the plant, you know, inject this hormone mimicking compound into the plant to make it make the gall. But it has to be in very precise location. And then the young basically have the structure grow around them. And so it builds a home around them while they sit there and feed in perfect contentment. And so what else? So they have a home and food, but what's it now protecting? Yeah, it's protecting.
From predators.
Yeah, so who's going to be able to get to that insect inside the gall? Nobody.
And if you look at a gall on a blue spruce, I think we've all seen them, but we may just not have known
what they were.
They start out red, and then when they dry out, it goes brown.
Right.
But they're little, I think it's just needles that are poking up through the gall.
Exactly.
Is that what it is? And so what insect's going to want to get through all those needles to get to?
So in the case of the coulee spruce gall adelgid, that's the full name for that one that you see on the blue spruce around here, it's laying its eggs right on that new little, we call it the candles, where the new needles are forming right underneath, and you've probably seen those little sheaths of kind of skin that come off when the new needle growth comes out, and it's really tender underneath. And that's right where it's laying its eggs, right there at the base of that, so that the young adelgids, which are like an aphid, can get to that those new needles and feed. And then instead of having normal needles, it makes this kind of like prickly looking pine cone. I've heard people say, what are those pine cones on my spruce? And it's these galls that they've formed. And so they are still leaves or needles, but they've been greatly altered to make this structure. And I just brought along a book. You out there in Radioland can't see it, but just for Brian, you can leaf through all the different kinds of insect galls. So some of the most common groups of insects that make galls are the aphids and the adelgids and psyllids. These are all have these piercing, sucking mouth parts. But there's also, as I mentioned, the gall wasps. These are the ones that make more of the like apple-looking structures on like oaks and things. And there's some flies that make galls. And there's also aerophyid mites, these little teeny tiny mites that make little bumps on leaves and things that are galls. So they're really quite fascinating. And like the honey locust pod gall midge, that's a fly. If you've ever had honey locust, and then instead of the leaves being these normal leaves, are like little round, little knobby things.
Mm-hmm. I've seen the little red bumps.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually pulled those open to discover that there was a little worm inside. So I knew something was going on.
It's so fun. And I mean, of course, I'm an entomologist. So people would say this is, you know, you think this is fun. But when it was the greatest thing when my kids were little and we were trying to get them into wanting to hike on local trails and, you know, how kids are, oh, I'm tired. Are we there yet? I would show them different kinds of insect galls you can see along the trail, and other things too, but galls were one of the fun things because they had this little prize inside, this little exciting thing that you just said. You can break them open and see the little worm inside. And so we talk about the different kinds of galls on rabbit brush and sage and different kinds of plants, and they would walk along and see who could. I had two kids, and they were competing to see who could find, you know, the next gall, and so it was a way to get them to hike down the trail. That was my goal.
Sounds like it worked. So with our native plants, have they evolved this mechanism to either ward off some of these galls or to be able to at least survive and not have enough energy tapped out of them that they can't keep going?
Right. I mean, there certainly are many native plants and native insects that do cause galls. So they're not excluded. I mean, some of our ones that cause some of our biggest problems tend to be the invasive ones, the ones that, you know, weren't here naturally with the plant to start with, or they, you know, developed somewhere else and then now they're causing more problems. But generally, they're not too pestiferous in their nature. There's a few exceptions, some of these invasive ones, but mostly they live in harmony, so to speak, with the plant. I mean, yes, the plant is altered and it didn't have quite the normal growth in that area, but generally the galls aren't so numerous that they're impeding the health of the plant over time. They're generally able to kind of, you know, co-evolve together. And it makes sense if you're an insect that's utilizing a plant to make your home on, you don't want to kill it off because you need it to be there for you and your children to come.
I know when you look at, I keep coming up with blue spruce, but they look like little pine cones.
They do.
Some people might think that that's what they are, but they're not.
They're not.
So why don't you explore and see what's actually in there?
Yeah. So once those get hard and brown, you can use like a knife to cut them open. And you can just see there'll just be all these little empty hollow holes inside where the adelgids had lived in their little apartments, homes. If you get one that's still green and kind of purplish in color, sometimes it'll turn purplish, and cut that open, you will actually see the little adelgids still inside. And they're like little aphids that have a white waxy covering on them, so you can see them easily.
Diane, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and with me today is Shane Taylor, horticultural specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City. And he's here to recommend another house plant, and this one I've never heard of before, a Haworthia. Where did that name come from, and what is this plant?
Well, okay, there was a British lord, Adrian Hardy Haworth, that would send botanical expeditions into Africa. And they noticed this specific group of plants that had very unusual growth habits, often with translucent leaves where you could see inside the leaf. They call them window leaves. He found many different species all throughout the African continent, mostly on the southern end, of course, so where it's a little bit drier. And it is named after him. And it's ironic that his middle name is Hardy because these are very hardy plants. This is a type of succulent that if you're interested in getting into succulents and you want to try your hand at it, this would be a good plant to start with. It is closely related to aloe, although you'll find many stranger looking leaf forms than aloe has.
So when you're saying this is a hardy plant, it's not related to a hardiness zone, just that it's going to take a lot more punishment.
Yes, that's correct. Okay. Yeah, it's not cold hardy. You wouldn't want to put it out in your garden here, but it is a houseplant that will last even under some really tricky circumstances. So most succulents, because they're from the desert, of course, they need a lot of sun. And that's going to be the tricky thing about cactus and succulents is you've got to have them in a sunny window. Whereas Haworthia, because they have a lot in common with aloe, they're often growing in coastal regions with more fog, more cloud cover, and they can adapt to indirect light or to artificial lighting. On my desk at work, I have a species of Haworthia that just sits under an artificial light, and it has for almost a year now, and they do just fine. In fact, in a lot of sun, they'll tend to sunburn. They'll tend to get coloration red or even dark black on the leaves if they get too much sun.
I've noticed that it reminds me of hens and chicks because of the way that it's growing in the pot. There's like 6 different little plants.
Yeah, they are clump growers. Like many in the family, they will produce offsets. Or pups. And this specific variety, which is called Haworthia cymbiformis, has much more succulent leaves. It's much more rounded, and then it's very noticeably translucent on the tips where you can look down in. And that, those are adaptations. Keeping it as close to the ground as possible means that it's going to lose less water during the dry seasons in nature. And having those open leaves that let more light into the leaf allows it to absorb light even in lower lighting situations. So this is a plant that you can let dry out and you can keep in bright but indirect light and it will do great. And not many succulents can say that.
Hmm. So you can do it in bright indirect light or you can keep it in really low light with just a fluorescent light above it. I mean, it sounds like the one that's sitting on your desk.
Yeah.
Seems to be doing pretty well with that. So.
It is doing really well. It's just one of those little LEDs that you can screw into a regular light socket that's only 12 watts, and it sits about a foot or two below that desk lamp. And it comes on every day when I'm there. It's on for 8 hours or so per day, and it's enough to keep it happy and healthy.
Does it have to be transplanted very much?
You know, they do grow, and they grow at a pretty fast rate for a succulent, and they can be divided and transplanted on a regular basis. This one we've got here, you'll notice that the pot is already starting to squeeze out where it's really taking up a lot of its space in the container, and it's ready to either be divided or moved up. And if you move it up, it's going to keep spreading out, keep producing pups. If you divide it, it'll take it a little bit longer to start over and start producing those offsets.
So it won't get much taller than it is right now. It'll just spread. So like right now, it's maybe 1.5 to 2 inches.
Yeah, this tall variety, that's basically as tall as it gets. There are some taller varieties of Haworthia, but of course the tallest being still shorter than about a foot, maybe 8 to 10 inches tall is going to be the tallest variety of Haworthia that I can think of. A lot that trail. There are several varieties that will spill over the sides of the container and trail down, like Haworthia retusa eventually will trail. They're great plants. You don't need to fertilize them. You just water them when they're dry. They are collected because of their really unusual leaf shapes. You'll get many that look like somebody's taken a set of shears and chopped the leaves perfectly flat, and that perfectly flat top of the leaf will be translucent. You'll be able to look down inside the leaf. There are just some really fun varieties of Haworthia.
And this one has a little bit of striping on the underside of the leaf as well.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of pattern. This variety, cymbiformis, also comes in variegation, sometimes with white or yellow variegation. It's a little bit more rare. You'll find rare varieties of Horthia on the internet, sometimes selling for hundreds of dollars because people really are into collecting different types and different varieties.
And if you had, what cost are we looking at just to purchase a small one like this?
Oh, often you'll find some of these more common Horthias in general succulent assortments at your regular grocery store or here at our shop. We bring in specific varieties if we can, or we bring them in with our assortments as well. This guy retails at our store for $5.95.
So pretty inexpensive for a houseplant.
Yeah, absolutely. And something that will continue to live and thrive indefinitely. One of the people I work with, she has an extensive collection of Horthia, and she brings them in to divide them about once every 18 months to 2 years, and she's always giving starts to other people. I've got a couple starts from her, and they're just fun plants. They're great, unusual succulents that will give you some good texture, some good color.
What will it look like if you are beating it up too much? You talked about if it gets too much light.
If it gets too much light, it's going to start turning red. You'll know they sunburn just like us. They'll get that red blush to the tips of the leaves. And at first, that red won't hurt it at all. Some people actually prefer the plant to have a little bit of that color just because it's, you know, something different or unique. If it deepens to like a maroon or a deep, like a reddish black, you know that the plant is moving towards actual leaf damage at that point. So that means it's got too much light. And of course, like any succulent, because their leaves are thick and fleshy, if you poke it or bump it or break it, that damage shows up permanently. And until that part of the plant is overgrown by other parts of the plant, it will look damaged. The most common way people kill their Horthias is the same as every other plant. They tend to overwater. And these plants tend to like to go a little bit drier. So it's very important to let them go a little bit longer. And that seems to be one of the themes of the plants that I pick personally, because I'm one of those people that forgets. So I have to have plants. I like plants that I can forget about. And this is one of those plants.
Okay, so we're talking about the Horthia, and Shane Taylor, horticultural specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals, is in the studio with me. You know, I wanted to ask you about your job, because you're a buyer, and that sounds like it'd be awesome, because you could just look at all of these different plants, and of course you've got to think about, all right, so the general public, how are they, would they be accepting of this? But, I mean, just personally, I think it'd be so hard to choose. Because you get to go out and see all the different things, the different plants that are available.
It's a really fun job. It's something that I very much enjoy doing. One of the fun things about working at Cactus and Tropicals is over the years I've got to do a little bit of everything. And so this is my most recent position. And it's fun. Not only do you get to see all these plants, but you get to go out and see all these plants. So I just recently came back from Florida, where I was able to go through these giant growers, huge greenhouses where they're growing these succulents and these ferns and these house plants and in massive buildings and just neat varieties.
So you go down with the budget, so you know what you can bring back and you have to limit yourself.
Oh yeah, we always have to stay pretty strict to the budget. It's good and it's bad. Like you said, the general public, you kind of have to buy for that, and that can make it a little bit more narrow, because generally the plants that the general public use are going to be stuff like Dracaenas and Pothos and the stuff that are fairly common that we see every day. And the thing that gets us excited, that gets me excited, are those plants that you don't see every day. But one of the reasons that you don't see them every day is they're not going to be super easy to grow. So.
So maybe every once in a while you bring one of those back, because I'm sure you have some customers that just want to try something different.
Oh, absolutely. And that's something that at our shop that we really try to show off, is some of the weird stuff, some of the unusual house plants and some of the different varieties that you can grow. And so we do go out and look for things that you would normally not see at your regular grocery store or your Home Depot or whatnot.
Well, I appreciate you coming in. Thanks for being there for us.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Shane Taylor, horticulture specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City. It's the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and it's our new For Eat's Sake segment. It's with Barney Northrup. Barney is the head chef at Herm's Inn in Logan, and I've wanted to do a segment on cooking, and it just makes sense. Cooking and vegetables are going to go together, so I really appreciate you coming on the program.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So the first one we probably should look at is tomatoes.
Yeah, I think tomatoes are the quintessential garden item that a lot of people grow in general, but they're my favorite thing to grow in my garden.
Why? What do you like to do with them?
Well, number one, the varietals that you can have in your own garden versus what you're able to buy at a store. The only market that rivals the store would be your farmer's market, which is very seasonal, and they can also be very spendy. And for the price of a few seeds, you can have a really nice array of tomatoes.
Well, and anyone who has grown a home tomato knows how much better they taste. And they do really well in boxes or in raised beds and in a smaller area than some other vegetables would do.
Oh yeah, when I was younger, in my 20s, even late teens, if I was living in apartments, I liked to grow in buckets because I was able to
like a 5-gallon bucket.
Exactly. Yeah. Pickle buckets. You know, they're most restaurants have them or something similar to them. And you can get them for free, but you drill a few holes in the bottom and you've got enough soil that will sustain a full-grown tomato plant.
So maybe you should back up a little bit. Cooking. Why cooking for you? Where did that start? And condense it all down.
Okay. Well, so I've got over 18 years in the business now. And it started as, you know, I wanted a job, needed a job, wanted to make some money. And my brother had previously been working at a restaurant. This was up in Idaho. My first job, it's now closed, but it was called the Main Street Grill. I don't know if you're familiar with it, how long you've been in the area.
But, yeah.
This was its first incarnation. They had a second incarnation that was short-lived, but I had an inn, knew the owner. They hired me as a dishwasher, and a few months later, I was able to start cooking on the line. And I actually worked a few different capacities in the restaurant. I would bus tables. I would be a banquet server. And but my favorite was the kitchen. I always loved to cook since I was a kid, whether that was making bread with my grandmother or, you know, if it was taco night at home, and I actually got to do some food preparation.
So you found your passion.
Well, I think it more grew into a passion. You know, you have a few aha moments where you taste something, flavor combinations, or you just feel a sense of pride for what you're producing. And I don't know, it really, really grew on me. So,
well, then let's take that passion and then talk about the tomatoes. What do you do with tomatoes? Of course, this is a radio program, so we're not going to be able to show you anything elaborate, but there's some simple things that you can do with tomatoes. What's your favorite thing to do with them?
I guess it depends on the tomato. Depending upon what varietals you grow, you know, my favorite for, say, making a sauce or a soup would be Roma-style tomatoes. So San Marzano are a great varietal to grow. I love those. Yeah, just for any time I would be stewing tomatoes, making, if I was braising any meat with a tomato sauce, I'd use, like your Roma-style tomatoes. For your juicier, you know, I guess beef steak is the commercial varietal, but anything similar to a large juicy tomato. I really like Cherokee Purple.
So is an heirloom.
Mm-hmm. I'll eat those right off the vine. You just pick them and eat them like an apple. They're delicious. I know a lot of people that are off put by that. they don't like raw tomatoes. They'll eat them cooked. Yeah.
I readily admit, and my friends just go, what? You're a gardener and you don't like fresh tomatoes? There's just something about eating it fresh. But once it's mixed in with something, once it's on a hamburger, once it's in a salad, a caprese salad, for instance. Wow.
Yeah. And so for caprese salad, I really like to use the cherry tomatoes and then your smaller fresh mozzarella balls, you know. You know, and yeah, if you're growing tomatoes, you may as well grow basil. They like a lot of the same conditions. And so, yeah, you're only one step away from a caprese salad with the fresh mozzarella. So
if you had one opportunity to use a tomato, what would you do with it?
Oh, only one.
It's the last tomato on earth. What would you do with it?
Then I'm
probably just eat it fresh.
I'm just going to dive right in, yeah, and eat it like an apple. Yep, just eat
okay,
it.
There's something keeping you from eating it fresh. You have to use it. What would you do with it?
Probably make some fresh-made pasta, make a simple tomato sauce. Just some tomatoes, onions, garlic, basil if I've got it, salt, pepper, and olive oil. Just keep it very simple. Keep the flavor of the tomato clean, and yeah, and there's nothing wrong with fresh made pasta. So
not mixing up with a lot of other flavors. When you say keeping it clean, what do you talk about that a little bit?
Sometimes you read a recipe and there's just a little bit too much in there, especially, you know, if you're going to take the time to grow a tomato, and you've got 3 months where you're taking care of these plants. And you're watching them sprout, you watch them flower, they start to produce some fruit, and then you've got the long-awaited ripening time. I think that you really should respect that ingredient, and you're growing that tomato for its flavor of tomato. So, yeah, not convoluting it. The simpler, the better.
Do you do sun-dried tomatoes?
I don't do sun-dried tomatoes generally. Number one, because if you're using the sun, you know, that means they're outside, and so you've got pest problems. So definitely in a restaurant setting, I can't take any of my food outside and just leave it in the sun. What I can do is oven-dried tomatoes. So an oven on very, very low, as in 200 or below, 200 degrees Fahrenheit or below, or if you've got a gas oven with a pilot light, which we typically have in my business, you just leave it overnight in an oven with a pilot light. And it's about 150 or so degrees, and it slowly dries them out. And it takes a long time, but you have ultimate control over how much moisture is left in those tomatoes. So if you don't want them super-duper dry, you know, if you want a slightly juicier tomato, then you can take them out and throw them in an olive oil marinade, or you know, you've got a window where you can stop that drying process.
So you just pull it out and do it, just try it, and if it's right where you want it, okay, they're done.
Exactly. And generally for those, I'll use like a Roma tomato, cut in either halves or quartered, and you set it skin side down, so the cut side facing up.
And do you put any, so is it just like in a jelly roll pan or?
Well, yeah, we use, so yeah, restaurant industry again,
right.
Sheet pans.
Yep.
So, you know, you've got, typically in your home use, you'll have either half or quarter sheet, and we use the big guys, the 18 by 24, full sheet pans.
And do you spray a little bit of olive oil down?
You can, but the skin is typically enough to keep it from sticking.
Oh, okay.
So, but you can toss them in olive oil, or yeah, use like a cooking spray, or if you have a Silpat, like a silicone baking mat, nothing sticks to those.
And those work pretty well. I've never actually used one.
They work great.
Okay.
Yeah, I highly suggest them. I've got probably at least a dozen, and they work great. And if you don't cut them, they will last forever. Mm. So.
And do you quarter the tomatoes or put them in eighths?
I generally do halved or quartered.
Okay.
So,
and when you're talking about a Roma tomato, they're not that big
anyway.
So
no, I mean, they're the size of generally between a lemon and a lime. So, yeah.
And so you put those skin side down. Mm-hmm. And
so the cut side is facing up.
Yes.
And yeah, that skin, even in contact with the pan, Even as it starts to shrink, it will not stick.
Any kind of seasoning at all, or you're just drying the tomato?
I'll usually do a simple salt, pepper, and a little bit of sugar, just a small amount to help boost that natural sweetness of the tomato. But I think anything more than that is kind of
common. Overkill.
Yeah. I mean, we're trying to, through this drying process, we're trying to concentrate that tomato flavor. And so
I'm thinking of a recipe that we cut off of a box somewhere like 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was something to do with the Super Bowl. Anyway, it had bow tie pasta, hot sausage, and sun-dried tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And I just adore this recipe. It's so good because it's pretty basic. Mm-hmm. But I just... that's where I learned to really enjoy sun-dried tomatoes. So I'm thinking, okay, yeah, you can buy these in a jar if you want in the store, but yeah, you can do it yourself. Why not?
Exactly. And it's that preservation, you know. If you're growing tomatoes, you'll end up with an extra amount. That, yeah, it's, you can only give so many to your neighbors before they just start throwing them in the trash, you know. But
so once they're to that point that they're done, that you feel like they're done, mm-hmm, how do you preserve them?
At that point, it kind of depends on what you're going to want to do with them. Yes, you can do the just pack them in olive oil and store them in your fridge, and they last almost indefinitely. My girlfriend, she does a lot of canning, so you know, you can make it into sauces and either hot water bath or pressure can them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got summer in a jar all winter long.
Can you freeze tomatoes, or do they tend not to do so well that way?
You can, especially if you've pulled that water content out, because it's the freezing process as the water forms ice crystals. That's typically what will be detrimental to your freezing.
So it bursts the cells, mm-hmm, and then makes it mushy.
Yeah, it makes it mushy, exactly. Which, if you're going to do that, you know, you're going to end up with a mushy tomato. Well, what are you going to do with that? Probably make it into tomato sauce.
Which you should have just done in the first place.
In the first place, exactly. So
then you possibly could freeze sun-dried tomatoes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. So
anything else about tomatoes?
Grow them. They're awesome.
Okay. All right. Well, you've been listening to For Eat's Sake. It's our new segment from the Zesty Garden. Barney Northrup is the head chef at Herm's Inn in Logan, and we'll have him back in again. Thanks, Barney.
Thanks.
You're listening to the Going Native segment of the Zesty Garden. Barney Barnett is co-owner of Willard Bay Gardens in Willard, and today we're talking about Fallujah, also known as Apache Plume, and I think this is also a Utah's choice plant. And I've got an Apache plume. What I need to ask about it is, I think I'm supposed to be cutting it back a little bit to help it be a little bit more unruly, but I love the seed heads on it.
Apache plume is one of the shrubs in the garden and one of the native shrubs in the garden that can, C-A-N, be pruned and the plant will be just fine. There's a lot of things that we ought not to just cut back just because we feel like it, and this is one that you can. You can cut it back to whatever size within reason. I guess I should say what size. 2 to 3 feet. You can cut it back to 2 to 3 feet and let the new growth come, and you won't hurt the plant at all.
And it's got a great smell to the leaves. What else? Oh, I see insects that are always buzzing through. Is it white flowers?
So come on. So pretty much with the Apache plume, you have pink buds, B-U-D-S, buds, and then the buds open to give you a white flower, nickel size, maybe quarter size flower that opens slightly, and it's hard to describe. Maybe somewhat star-shaped. I'm not quite sure how to describe that flower. And then when it's done blooming, you have what we call smoke, which means there's a little seed head that has this hairy look, almost as if it was smoke coming from it.
Kind of pink,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the thing that's really unique about Apache plume is you can have buds, B-U-D-S, and flowers and smoke all at the same time. It's not like I'm budding, now I'm flowering, now I'm throwing my seeds, my seed heads, but I'm doing it all the time, all summer long. And so it just has a really unique look to it. Now, you talked about it being a little bit unkempt. That is its habit. It doesn't have a habit that has a perfect shape. And that is, for some, why they like it. Mm-hmm. And for others, maybe they say, oh, no, I want to keep it a little bit tidier. Either way is perfectly fine.
Now, what will this tolerate as far as soil and water conditions?
It will tolerate any soil. Its water conditions preference is less water to completely no water.
And I have
after
this
establishment
in an area that has, I don't give it any extra water.
Yeah,
so
it's fine. It'll take some and be okay, but it wants to be in the drier side, in a drier garden, or in the drier side of a garden that's getting moisture.
And we're talking as far as height. I mean, mine is right now 4.5-5 feet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be pretty much native size, mature size, 4 to 5 by 4 to 5-ish. So if you let it go, that's what you're going to expect. If you choose to do some pruning on it, cutting it back, then you could keep it at 3 or 4. I don't think you want to keep it any less than that, because the full feel and presence of the plant you won't appreciate if you're cutting it back more than that.
Mm. And how far south will it grow? How much
heat? I think it grows throughout all of the Great Basin, so into Arizona, Nevada, Utah, Colorado. So it'll take colder and it'll take warmer, hotter, and be perfectly acceptable, perfectly happy.
When you're seeing a mature plant with all of these little seed heads on it, it's
glorious.
Yeah, it's just fantastic looking. It's like you said, it's like there's smoke hovering all over the whole plant. It's very light and airy looking.
The stems, when they're a little bit older, will have a little bit of peeling bark as well. So that adds to this look, this native look that it gets.
Anything else with Fallujah or Apache plume that you would recommend? Would you plant something along with it?
Well,
because it's a large plant.
Perhaps some ornamental grasses that would be taller or shorter, either way. With that white color and white to pink, probably something that might be blue. You could have something that's blue that would do that. The flowers basically bloom mid-June to frost, and the flowers, the smoke, the buds. So you can have a number of things that you could have it work against.
And the foliage stays on quite a long time.
Foliage stays on quite a long time, yeah. Olive green, very and nice looking foliage, mm-hmm, as well.
Great. Well, we've been talking about Fallujah, or also known as Patchy Plume. Barney Barnett has been in studio with me, and he's co-owner of Willard Bay Gardens in Willard. Thanks, Barney.
Thank you, Brian.
Before we move on to Petals and Pros, I have a couple of items from the Zesty Garden calendar. Tonight from 5 to 6 p.m., Juab County Extension presents a rose care, pruning, and management class at the Memorial Rose Garden, 110 East 100 North in Nephi. Bring hand pruners, loppers, gloves, and wear a long-sleeved shirt or jacket. The information is at extension.usu.edu/Juab. The Cache County Master Gardeners present their Gardening in a Changing Climate lecture this Wednesday, April 6th, at the Willow Park Zoo Wildlife Learning Center, 6 to 7 p.m. Rose Greer presents Monarchs and Butterfly Gardening Basics. Information is at bridgerlandaudubon.org. A class to help you design an annual flower bed is Saturday, April 9th, from 9 to 10:30 a.m. at the Ogden Botanical Gardens. Learn how to plan for color and interest all season long with easy-to-follow steps. Information is at ogdenbotanicalgardens.org. Also at the Botanical Gardens is a 2-hour workshop where you can learn how to graft fruit trees. And it's Thursday, April 14th from 11 to 1 p.m. Participants will take home two grafted apple trees with selections from various heirloom and modern apple varieties. Additional rootstocks and scion wood may be purchased. It's $20 and pre-registration is required. Go to ogdenbotanicalgardens.org. And in Cache County, this same workshop is Friday, April 15th at the Willow Park Zoo Wildlife Education Center. Pre-registration is at 752-6263. If you have an item for the Zesty Garden calendar, wherever you listen to us, let us know about it by sending it to zestygarden@gmail.com.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. And this morning, I decided to read to you about mosses, which are technically not flowers. They do not have petals, but I thought they belonged, and I do like the book that I'll be using called Gathering Moss by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And regarding mosses as not being flora, the word moss is commonly applied to plants which are not actually mosses. Reindeer moss is a lichen. Spanish moss is a flowering plant. Sea moss is an alga. And club moss is a lycophyte. So what is a moss? A true moss, or bryophyte, is the most primitive of land plants. Mosses are often described by what they lack in comparison to the more familiar higher plants. They lack flowers, fruits, and seeds, have no roots, they have no vascular system, no xylem, no phloem to conduct water. They are the most simple of plants, and in their simplicity, elegant. With just a few rudimentary components of stem and leaf, evolution has produced some 22,000 species of moss worldwide. Each one is a variation on a theme, a unique creation designed for success in tiny niches in virtually every ecosystem. Robin Wall Kimmerer begins her book with the chapter, The Standing Stones. Barefoot, I've walked this path by night for nearly 20 years, most of my life, it seems, the earth pressing up against the arch of my foot. More often than not, I leave my flashlight behind to let the path carry me home. My feet touching the ground are like fingers on the piano, playing from memory with an old sweet song of pine needles and sand. Without thinking, I notice step down carefully over the big root, the one by the big sugar maple, where garter snakes bask every morning. I whacked my toe there once, so I remember. At the bottom of the hill, where rain washes out the path, I detour into ferns for a few steps, avoiding sharp gravel. The path rises over a ridge of smooth granite where I can feel the day's warmth still lingering in the rock. The rest is easy. Sand and grass. Past the place where my daughter Larkin stepped into a nest of yellowjacks when she was six. Past the thicket of stripped maple where we once found a whole family of baby screech owls lined up on a branch, sound asleep. I turn off toward my cabin, just at the spot where I can hear the spring dripping, smell its dampness, and feel its moisture rising up between my toes. I first came here as a student to fulfill my undergraduate requirement for field biology at Cranberry Lake Biological Station. This is where I was first introduced to mosses, following Dr. Ketledge through the woods, discovering mosses with the aid of the standard issue hand lens, the Ward Scientific student model borrowed from the stockroom that I wore around my neck on a dirty string. I knew I was committed when at the end of the class I spent part of my sparse college savings to send off for a professional grade Bausch & Lomb lens like his. I still have that lens and wear it on a red cord as I take my students along the trails at Cranberry Lake, where I return to join the faculty and to eventually become the biostation director. In all those years, the mosses haven't changed nearly as much as I have. That patch that Ket showed us along the Tower Trail is still there. Each summer, I stop for a closer look and wonder at its longevity. These past few summers, I've been conducting research on rocks, trying to learn what I can about how communities form. by observing the way moss species gather together on boulders. Each boulder stands apart like a desert island in a swelling sea of forest. Its only inhabitants are mosses. We're trying to figure out why one rock, 10 or more species of moss, may comfortably coexist, while a nearby, outwardly the same rock, is dominated by just a single moss living alone. What are the conditions that foster diverse communities rather than isolated individuals? The question is very complex for mosses, let alone for humans. By summer's end, we should have a tidy little publication, our scholarly contribution to the truth about rocks and mosses. Glacial boulders are scattered over the Adirondacks, the round tumbled granite left behind by ice 10,000 years ago. Their mossy bulk makes forests seem primeval, yet I know how much the scenery has changed around them from the day they were stranded in a barren plain of glacial outwash to thick maple woods that surround them today. Most of the boulders reach only to my shoulders, but for some we need a ladder to survey them completely. My students and I wrap measuring tape around their girth. We record light and pH, collect data on the number of crevices and the depth and thin skin of humus. We carefully catalog the positions of all the moss species, calling out their names. Struggling to record all this begs for shorter names. But mosses don't have only scientific names conferred with legalistic formality according to protocol. A good number of rocks around here have names, and people use them for reference points around the lake. Chair rock, gull rock, burnt rock, elephant rock, sliding rock. Each name calls up a story and connects us to the past and present of this place every time we say it. My daughters have been raised in a place where they simply assume that all rocks have names, christened their own. Bread rock, cheese rock, whale rock, reading rock, diving rock. The names we use for rocks and other beings depends on our perspective, whether we are speaking from the inside or the outside of the circle. The name on our lips reveals the knowledge we have of each other, hence the sweet secret names we have for the ones we love. The names we give ourselves are a powerful form of self-determination, of declaring ourselves sovereign territory. Outside the circle, scientific names for mosses may suffice, but within the circle, what do they call themselves? One of the charms of the biostation is that it doesn't change much from summer to summer. We can put it on each June like a faded flannel shirt, still smelling of last summer's wood smoke. It's the bedrock of our lives, our true home, a constant amidst other changes. There hasn't been a summer when pergolas don't nest in the spruces by the dining hall. In mid-July, before the blueberries ripen, a bear will regularly wander through camp, hungry. Beavers swim like clockwork past the front dock 20 minutes after sunset, and the morning mist always hangs longest in the south call on Bear Mountain. Oh, sometimes things change. On a hard winter, the ice might shift the driftwood on the shore. Once a silvery old log, the one with a branch like a heron's neck, got moved 60 feet down the bay. And one summer, the sapsuckers ended up nesting in a different tree after the top blew out of the rotten old aspen in a gale. On the sand, the way the lake can go from flat calm to 3-foot rollers, the way aspen leaves sound hours before a rain, the way the texture of evening clouds foretells the next day's winds. I find strength and comfort in this physical intimacy with the land, a sense of knowing the names of the rocks, knowing my place in the world. On this wild shore, my internal landscape is a near-perfect reflection of the external world. So I was stunned by what I saw today. On what had always been a familiar trail, a few miles down the shore from my cabin, it stopped me in my tracks. Disoriented, I caught my breath, glancing all around to reassure myself I was still on the same trail and hadn't wandered into some twilight zone where things are not as they seem. I've walked this path more times than I can tell, and yet it was only today that I was able to see them. 5 stones, each the size of a school bus, lying together in a pile, their curves fitting together like an old married couple secure in each other's arms. The glacier must have pushed them into this loving conformation and moved on. I circle around the pile in silence, brushing my fingertips over its mosses. On the east side, there is an opening, a cave-like darkness between the rocks. Somehow, I knew it would be there. The door, which I have never seen before, looks strangely familiar. My family comes from the Bear clan of the Potawatomi. Bear is a holder of medicine knowledge, for the people has a special relationship with plants. He is the one who calls them by name and knows their stories. We seek him for a vision. We find the task we were meant for. I think I am following a bear. The landscape itself seems alert, with every detail in a naturally sharp focus. I stand in an island of surreal quiet, where time feels weighty on the rocks, and yet when I shake my head, clearing my vision, I can hear the familiar whoosh of waves on the shore, and the red starts chittering over my head. The cave draws me inward, on my hands and knees, into the dark, beneath tons of rock. Imagining the den of a bear, I creep ahead, the rock rough against my bare arms. Around a turn, the light from the outside disappears behind me. I breathe in the coolness, and there is no scent of bear, just soft ground and the smell of granite. I don't know how long I was gone, minutes or hours. For that interval, I had no sensation of my own existence. There was only rock and moss and rock. Like a hand laid gently on my shoulder, I come back to myself and look around. The trance is broken. I can hear red starts again calling overhead. The encircling walls are radiant with mosses of every kind. I see them again as if for the first time, the green and the gray, old and new. In this place and this time, they rest together for the moment between glaciers. My ancestors knew that rocks hold Earth's stories, and for a moment I could hear them. My thoughts feel noisy here, an annoying buzz disrupting the slow conversation among the stones. The door on the wall has reappeared, and time starts to move again. An opening into the circle of stones was made, and a gift given. I can see things differently from the inside of the circle as well as from the outside. A gift comes with responsibility. I had no will at all to name the mosses in this place, to assign their Linnaean epithets. I think the task given to me is to carry out the message that mosses have their own names. Their way of being in the world cannot be told by data alone. They remind me to remember there are mysteries for which a measuring tape has no meaning. Questions and answers have no place in the truth about rocks and mosses. The tunnel seems easier on the way out. This time I know where I am going. I look back over my shoulder at the stones and then set my feet to the familiar path for home. I know I am following a bear. This is Helen Cannon. Thank you for listening.
This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KCEU 89.7 Price, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.